netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This episode of the FX Podcast is brought to you by SideFX Software, makers of Houdini, a faster, easier, more productive workflow, giving artists more control in their day-to-day work. Visit SideFX Software at SIDGRAPH Asia in Singapore, November 28th to November 30th, at booth number C01.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. In this episode, Mike Seymour speaks with Steve Begg, overall visual effects supervisor for the latest Bond film, Skyfall. The film features work from several companies, including Cinesite, MPC, DNAG, and Framestore. Skyfall set a new opening weekend record for the 50-year-old franchise, and so far has made close to $590 million worldwide. Skyfall had a budget of $200 million. Let's join Mike Seymour now, speaking with Steve Begg.
So firstly, congratulations on finding an audience. The film has been hugely successful in really finding an audience, and it must be rewarding to have such good reviews from both the critics, but also, of course, from the public.
Yeah, I mean, I knew we were working on something quite unusual with the likes of Roger Deakins and Sam Mendes involved. But I'm very pleasantly surprised with the sort of audience and reception and critical reception it's got. I mean, I knew it was going to do well, but I didn't expect it to do as well as this.
I heard Sam talking, and he was saying that obviously he's done films with visual effects before, but he wasn't really, from his point of view, he said he hadn't really worked with, you know, like dedicated senior VFX people as well as obviously senior stunt people and senior specialists in these kind of areas. How did you find that experience? Because clearly this was a film that needed to manage special and visual effects because it's just that kind of a film.
Working with Sam was quite a surprise, actually. So I went in expecting, you know, someone, in fact, he put his cards on the table very early on and said, look, I don't know, I've never done any of this, I've never done anything on this scale, you guys have to advise me, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. But what I was pleasantly surprised about was the fact that he has a hell of a good eye. And, you know, particularly on the visual effects side of things, he'd often spot things before we did. And the last time I experienced anything like that was when I worked on Aliens with James Cameron. So although he's got this reputation for being an actorly director, performance-driven director, he's got a very, very good eye. In fact, a lot better than a lot of the recent directors I've worked with. I was very surprised about that, pleasantly.
And you mentioned Roger Deakins before, obviously one of the world's best DOPs, but it was Roger, wasn't it, that suggested going digital for the first time in the Bond franchise with the Arri Alexa?
It was Roger that pushed for that, yeah. I think he field-tested quite a few cameras, the Red and this, that, and the other, and the Alexa was the one that he particularly went for. And I must say, even from my point of view, it was a good experience. It was a good camera.
Yeah, I was going to mention it just in terms of workflow, but I should say I saw a 4K digital projection of it in at a sort of a special press screening, and your work in 4K was remarkable. I mean, much more so than I would have even expected, given that obviously the Alexa isn't shooting at 4K. But I couldn't help but thinking that it left nowhere for, say, the wire removal team to hide, because like that opening train sequence, I mean, I was reading phenomenal detail in the shots off the 4K print from the Alexa RAW files. Presumably that was recorded on codecs in RAW format, was it, that your team was working with?
Yes, it was. Yeah, they had a codec attached to the back of the camera, and then sometimes they hardwired it into a, you know, another codec system. We worked on everything at 2K, funnily enough. I don't know if there was some image sharpening or something going on afterwards in the DI, but yeah, you're right. I mean, nothing jumps out at you as being a sort of degradation when you come to the visual effects shots.
I must admit that the impression I kind of got was that what I was seeing was it was carrying forward the work that your team had done, rather than, you know, having that usual sort of drop in resolution at the projection stage. It really felt like, I mean, it looked like I was looking at something off a really good God monitor. It was just that good. But it did strike me that this meant that, that you know, that there really needed to be quite a lot of finessing, because if I was getting that off the projected experience, it would be, I'm sure, the same off a Blu-ray as well. So if I could talk about the companies that you had involved. You had, what, CineSight, MPC, DNEG, and a few others?
Yeah, I mean, off the top of my head, it was, and in fact, I think this is in order of work, the amount of work. DNEG, MPC, Peerless, CineSight, Envisage, Lola US, and Blue Bolt, and Base Black did some stuff as well.
Right. So
there was, all in all, there was about 1,300 shots.
Which is interesting, because there's a lot made about the fact that Bond does stuff for real. But it strikes me that even if there is stuff being done for real, this is a marriage of practical and visual. And I presume you worked very closely with Chris, who was the special effects supervisor.
Yeah, I did. Chris Cobbold. Yeah. I come from, I've been around for years. And I come from the old, what they call the old school sort of visual effects background. So one of the things I really enjoyed more than anything on this film was the fact that we could, courtesy of digital cameras, more than just a CGI and post-production, what have you, I could actually shoot things and preview them, instantly. So there was quite a bit of miniature work in the film as well, which probably, if we were shooting on film, I probably wouldn't have gone for. I know a lot of digital cameras do this, but the Alexas we had were capable of doing 120 frames a second, so that when MI6 blows up, we had a quarter scale a section off the top of the building for that, which we shot about 60 frames a second. And then the miniature helicopter crash, which was third scale, and we shot that about 40 frames a second. So what's really cool about these cameras is the fact that I think you can actually employ a lot of old school tricks and then augment them with digital technology. And I think you get the best of both worlds out of it, as far as I'm concerned.
As I understand it, there was also a third-scale Aston Martin that was blown up that was actually, I believe from what I've read, something that came from the practical team, but they used a 3D printer. Did that mean that there was a sort of digital files that you guys deployed as well, or were you just adding digital over the top?
No, what happened was both the helicopter and the DB5, both third-scale, started as digital files, and they were, using some sort of rapid prototyping technique. They were fabricated by a company called Prop Store or something at Pinewood. And the great thing about it is it's phenomenally detailed, both the things were, and in a way that you would have, using conventional model making techniques, would have taken a hell of a lot longer to actually do. We used the third scale DB5 particularly for, as you say, the explosion, which was a marry up of Chris Corbell full scale explosion, and basically wiped on the third scale miniature, which was shot up and destroyed.
Right, I think that was Prop Shop, wasn't it? The model
Prop Shop, I beg your pardon.
Yeah. And so it must have been really good to have that kind of flexibility. But I was wondering, how early did you sort of sit down and work out each shot, where the split was going to be between digital and practical? Did that change? Was it something that you sort of just worked out all in pre-pro?
We did a certain amount of it in pre-production, but as always with these kind of films, it's quite an organic process. So a lot of these decisions came along later after we'd actually shot the thing. Sam and Roger are very, I can't think of a better word, but they're very organic filmmakers. You give them the setup and then they create in front of you. So I had to kind of go with the flow on that one, which was, a bit hard to start with. But once I got used to it, I think it worked out really well. On another side, as far as Roger's concerned, I know he's not a big fan of green screen or blue screen or anything like that. I just basically made sure that we had a clear background, be it grey, black, green, brown, whatever, so that we could do a a combination of Lumacaint and a lot of rotoscoping to pull out the foreground elements whenever we wanted to match something into the background. Now, actually, again, I think we got a really good result in it because we're not tampering with his photography.
Yeah, also it seemed like his lighting was just superb. I mean, some of those shots. And also I think, interestingly, the colour palettes, the blues in the Hong Kong assassination scene to the obviously the yellows in the Scotland fire stuff, but also the reds of the casino. It was just a very vivid palette that you guys were working with.
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised, actually. I don't know what to expect, but I didn't quite expect that. I mean, the good thing is Roger seems to have also captured him. Although it has a very stylized look, it's very cinematic and very colourful. Mm. And I think he's managed to capture this sort of feeling of the older James Bonds without being, you know, too reverential.
So, in fact, I mentioned there the Scottish Highlands, but as I understand it, the actual Scottish sequence wasn't shot in Scotland. It was put together. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, they found a location which was basically an old artillery where they test guns basically down just south of London, and they built a set there, and then it was up to us to add the environment, so all the mountains and this bits of snow you see on the hilltops and stuff are all added in post afterwards, although they did do a certain amount of shooting up in Scotland in Fort William for the opening sequence. So hopefully that when you see all that stuff for real, then you go to our fake stuff, the two kind of complement each other. So
I must admit, I think that sequence worked spectacularly well because the use of the miniatures I certainly didn't pick, but also the helicopter crash was just spectacular, and there was marvellous lighting with the previous gun battle that happened before it. How did you just integrate some of that crash sequence, presumably just to add extra explosions or something? I mean, how did that all come together?
Yes, I mean, the actual rotor blades and the actual their impact on the building was all CG, although the fuselage and the rest of the helicopters on a Chris Cobble mounted rig that we actually rammed into the miniature. So it's a hybrid. So this is what I'm saying. This is what I really like. I love this hybrid approach of using miniatures to kind of kick off the shot, and then you augment and sweeten it with CGI. And I'm glad to hear you thought that looked pretty good.
I think Kelly is the name of their finite element analysis destruction pipeline. It just seems to me that MPC really got a very good destruction pipe. I mean, I'm sure Dean Egan and CineSight and others do too, but that sequence just seemed to sing. How long did it take to sort of pull that together, and were the miniatures shot a long way from the principal photography, or were they sort of around the similar time? Or
the actual miniature shot was sequence was done towards the end of principal photography. The main unit were in Turkey at that particular time, and I stayed behind to do the miniature stuff with Chris Corbold. And then I think over a period of probably 2 or 3 months, MPC then worked on all that stuff, did a lot of rig removal. Any dodgy-looking fire elements, we painted that and replaced with full-scale stuff, and also did the rotor blades and stuff. I think they also did that. We also projected the helicopter image onto a 3D model just to give it a little bit more wobble and shudder on the actual impact. So again, it's a serious hybrid approach that you're looking at there.
Wow.
But one I'm very happy with.
Yeah, and I think it was just absolutely seamless, and it was good in the sense that it was sort of Bond-like. It was also very real, and it in no way sort of felt studio-bound. So it was remarkable to think it wasn't even in Scotland. You said the other first unit at that stage was in Turkey, and let's discuss the Turkey bike sequence. I'm guessing that you would have had to have had either stunt doubles or digital doubles for a lot of that rooftop riding, because I can't imagine Daniel Craig's insurance company had let him ride across the top of that.
Yeah, no, that's true. It's all primarily, it's real, with a limited amount of rig removal, a fair amount of head replacement work on it, which again was a combination of 3D heads and 2D heads, where we actually managed to get Daniel Craig and Ola Rapace on a green screen stage, and I got them to go through the basic motions And then we cut and pasted those heads on some shots, but the more dynamic shots were 3D shots. All of that work was put together by NPC. I beg your pardon, Double Negative. And the only time we resorted to a digi-double was on the last two shots of the fall from the bridge, where he falls into the water after he's been shot.
Right.
It's actually a three-cut sequence. The initial cut was done on location on the actual bridge in Varda in Turkey, with a stuntman and a bit of head replacement on him. And then the following two cuts are CGI digi-doubles.
I've seen some stunt photos, just PR shots, and it seems like the stunt double for Daniel Craig had three dots across his forehead. Was it easy to do a face replacement, or did you have to do head replacements because of the sheer complexity of trying to get the face right onto somebody else's head?
We put these dots on the heads, but invariably, because we're usually doing head replacement on an action sequence, they're moving really fast, so they're motion blurred to hell. So what happened was that when we'd have like a witness camera or even use like the, because it's an action sequence, there's usually multiple cameras, use different reference points so that the 3D animators would basically eyeball the head, on a 3D head, on top of the stunt performer. I must say, I think they did a very good job, considering how dynamic the actual moves were.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, they were primarily on cables that needed to be removed. So there was actually a lot of material you had, which was great because, I think it's always difficult with those green screen shots of two people on top of a train. It's some of the, if it doesn't work, it's so hokey. And this stuff worked tremendously well.
That's good to hear. I've got to say, because of the nature of the film, they do try to do everything as much as possible in camera. And our main deal usually is rig removal. But on a shot-by-shot basis, that changes. But it's primarily real stuff, and we've just added to it, really.
So were they real golfs that were being pummeled off the back of the by the digger before the train was ripped apart like a sardine can, or was there any digital work throughout that?
No, the only bit of digital work involved in that entire sequence is a very small amount of rig removal underneath the actual crane, which Chris Corbould had on a motion control mover, believe it or not. So the actual the crane's computer controlled.
Oh, wow.
And, but the golfs are real, and I'm assuming product placement golfs.
Odd product placement, isn't it? And I understand from Sam's talk that you just added stuff like sparks and other things just to maybe help with some of the ripping of the part of the train.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we added things onto it. With the exception of a bit of rig removal, we were basically adding bits and pieces on. The last shot of that sequence where you see the back end of the train fall away and skid across the tracks was entirely a sort of CGI 3D element created by Double Negative. And it was so good that when I showed it to Chris Corbould, who was in the UK with the main unit while the second unit were doing that sort of stuff, he was tempted to go and phone up his guys and say, well done. And I went, oh, hold on, that's CGI, Chris. He went, bloody hell.
Now, which shot was that? Tell me again which shot that was.
It's the very last shot of that sequence after Bond jumps down. I think he adjusts his sleeves on his jacket, the iconic shot where he's adjusting his suit just before he starts pursuing the villain through the train. He's just jumped off the digger. He leaves frame, and then you cut to an aerial shot looking down on the train,
yep,
and you see what appears to be the back end of it skidding across the tracks.
Right.
So that was 3D.
We said you shot on the Alexa, but I think some of those aerial shots you shot with an Epic in a helicopter or a gyro rig, I think, is that right? So some of that stuff.
That's correct, yeah. In fact, there's a few aerial shots, particularly in the bike sequence where you're you're following the bikes across the bizarre rooftop, and they were shot with radio-controlled mini helicopter setup with a red attached to it.
But while we're talking about trains, we need to talk about the tube train falling through the floor in the chase towards the assassination attempt on M. because there are many ways people could approach that. You could obviously do a digital destruction sim. You could make a miniature. You guys took what approach to that?
Again, it's Chris Cor- that was Chris Corbold's call. It's entirely full-scale. Built in the 007 stage at Pinewood, it was primarily two full-scale sections of the London Tube train on our, supported by our, a flying rig, which we had to remove, obviously. But everything you're seeing there is full scale. All we did was split screen bonding, so it appears to do a near miss on him. But otherwise, it's all in camera. A lot of people assume it's a big miniature. It's not. It's full scale.
Steve, I got a question about that because it struck me when I was watching it that there were no people in the tube. Was that a deliberate decision not to make it too gory, or why were they? Because the characters seem empty.
Yeah, no, it was actually. In fact, if you look at the very front of the train, it says out of service. Which we that was an afterthought, and that was something we tracked on afterwards.
Right.
Just in case there was a bit of London. Basically, London Underground were very, as you can imagine, were very helpful throughout the film, so we didn't want to upset them too much.
Right.
You know, with having too much death and destruction in the underground, that would not have gone down very well.
Now, there were some fully digital characters, not least of which was the Komodo Dragons and the Scorpion during the bar sequence at the beginning. Who handled those?
The Scorpion was done by the guys at and ladies at Envisage, and the Komodo Dragons were done by CineSight. The reason I went with these two companies, who are not traditionally known for creature work, is they were basically hungry to do this kind of work, and they both did kind of bucksy tests to prove they could do it. Ran them by Sam. He was happy with them, and you know, I'm always. I think we got some very good results out of them. Rather than going with the usual route with a company who's been doing a lot of this kind of work, I felt we'd just get a little bit more out of them than we were asking for, and I think we did.
The Scorpion seemed to have particularly good object tracking to sit on that hand for all of those shots. Mm. I thought that was really, like you just, I did sort of obviously stare at it because I had this great quality, and it didn't slide at all. It was really holding it well. So clearly they were, you know, working hard at it. So, I'm guessing though you mentioned before Lola. Would that be the denture face dropping evil? Because that was again seamless work. But
yeah, I knew that was coming out. In fact, it was going to be a hell of a lot more gory than it ended up being. But I thought, you know, we've got to get people that are really good at this sort of stuff. This is an area I didn't want to field test an outfit, you know, to see if they could do it. And I caught a little bit of Captain America. And
right.
I was particularly impressed by the scaling down of, you know, the youthful Captain America using 2D and 3D tricks and what have you. And I knew they had a particularly good reputation with that kind of work, so I felt in safe hands with these guys. And I think they delivered anyway. I thought what they did was terrific.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of their work from that and Hugo and a whole bunch of other stuff. They really, and a lot of people just think that that's just a, you know, a sort of digital whatever, but that just seems to be done normally with just painstakingly well done compositing, and it's a credit to them and you. It looks great.
No, the thing I particularly like about them is the fact that they don't just, you know, they don't automatically default to 3D, although they do a lot of 3D, but they don't automatically default that way all the time. I love the fact that they try, they basically throw a lot of manpower at it in a 2D way, and I think you get a much better look, you know, in the end result.
Well, you know, we're looking at it as the audience, and even if we're not completely, you know, staring at it at the start of the sequence, by the end when he puts it back in, it's almost you're sort of challenging us to find the fault because, you know, you're really studying because you now know what's going to be happening and you pass the initial shock. And as that face reforms, it's just spectacular.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, you know, you were talking about the 4K, 2K. We were talking about the 4K, 2K thing. If anywhere in the picture, that's the one bit that you would see a drop in image quality and you don't really. You know, or at least I'm not aware of it. You know?
No, I totally agree. I mean, we, you know, as an audience, you just can see it happen, but then you get to see it sort of unhappen, and that's where you really get to study it. And there's just nowhere to hide. So there's a vast amount of shots going on here, And I'm wondering, sort of, how long did all of this play out for you? How long did the production you in post?
We had, from what I remember, about 12 weeks, all in all, which is, as you can imagine, remarkably short for, you know, the amount of work that we were doing. But we were kind of helped a lot by the editor, Stuart Baird, who pretty much cuts things on the run all the time. So we were being handed over sequences quite early, you know, to start work on them with Sam's blessing, of course. And I mean, I didn't stop them from fiddling around with it afterwards, but that helped a hell of a lot, you know, that we could actually kickstart the VFX before we actually went into pre-production.
So 1,300 shots in 3 months?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, like I say, our post-production period was 3 months. We kick-started a lot of the effect shots well before that.
Right. And there are other sequences we haven't touched on, presumably, especially the underwater stuff, the frozen lake and stuff that happens at the very beginning of the shot, which I'm guessing was that done also by MPC, the underwater lake chase sequence stuff?
Yeah. And pretty much from the moment Bond arrives at Skyfall onwards, it's all NPC work. So yes, they did the underwater sequence. Again, primarily in camera, but with a lot of rotoscoping, and we had black. I didn't want to go a blue screen, green screen route, particularly with Roger's lighting. We hung a lot of black drapes actually in the actual tank. Then NPC rotoscoped Bond and the foreground characters off that, blurred the background, you know, so got rid of the textures of the cloth, lumikeyed the bubbles and what have you back on top again. So again, what you're looking at is pretty much in camera, but with that digital enhancement.
Tell me, what was the? I mean, the grading on this is a really nice film. It does look very natural, but it is vivid. Was that Company 3 did the grade? Did they? Or
that's correct. Yeah.
And so, did you have some lookup LUTs that you're working with along the way, or was it?
Yeah.
I mean, how sort of close was your stuff that you were dealing with to what the final look was, or did it get pushed around a lot after you handed it over?
Not really. Credit to Roger. What we shot on the day, what we saw in dailies, was pretty much what he wanted. I think it got a little bit tricky when we went from the day to dusk to night for the end sequence, but not spectacularly so. I mean, pretty much what you're seeing on the film is what Roger shot and what we saw on the DIT monitor on the actual set.
So I'm taking it that if you were moving forward with another project like this, you'd be comfortable going down this similar Alexa path, because it sounded like that digital on-set stuff was really helping you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I'm like I say, I am old school, and I like doing things in cameras as much as possible. I know there's limitations, but I think this new the digital camera technology, as far as I'm concerned, it's opened my eyes, and I think I can use a lot of the old tricks. I love it. Absolutely love it.
It's interesting, isn't it, that idea that new technology precludes using old techniques, when in reality, I mean, this, for example, we mentioned this 3D printer that's facilitated making the miniatures sort of better and easier, which actually allows them to be in the film as opposed to the other way around. It's certainly not a good idea to close your back on old school techniques just because there's some new tech that's come along.
Absolutely, Mike. No, I totally agree with that. I think, unfortunately, this is my take on it. A lot of my younger contemporaries haven't played around with the older tricks and techniques to the extent that I have. And I've never been married to one trick or another, really. I've never, even in the old school days, I was. I come from a matte painting, miniature, stop motion, photography background. And with this new technology, I have the same approach, basically. If I can get something built as a miniature and I think it's going to do 90% of the shot, I'll do it. And if I feel it makes more sense to do it entirely 3D, CG, so we can manipulate and push it around later, I'll do that. I'll go that route as well. So I'm not tied to one technique.
Because you were on Casino Royale, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And what were you doing on Casino Royale? Were you as VFX supervisor on that? I think you were, weren't you?
Yeah, I was a visual effects supervisor and also sort of in charge of the miniature shoot as well. We had a lot of miniatures on that. The Bond lot like miniatures, so I was quite pleased to keep that tradition going on Skyfall, you know, with Chris Corbell.
Because I think earlier in that you'd been on GoldenEye and a few other, I mean, obviously you'd done a ton of other films, not just hitting the, I'm just hitting these Bond films, but I'm just wondering how, you know, moving forward, given that you've got that history and not prying into anything that might happen, but I mean, is there any lessons from this that you would take forward other than the digital we've just been discussing? I mean, it seems like a pretty tight time frame. Would you want more time or did that work for you?
No, it worked for us. To be honest, I kind of enjoy the compressed, you know, post periods because it forces the director to make decisions quicker and everyone else and us. Obviously, there's some shots even now, I look at them, I think, oh God, I wish we had more time on that. Wish we had more time on this. I don't think I've ever worked on anything where you think everything's utterly flawless. But I actually quite like the accelerated or compressed post periods. I just think it forces everyone to sort of pull their finger out and make decisions. I'm quite happy with it.
Well, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us. Really do appreciate it. And I hope that your cold recovers soon. It's been great talking to you, and I loved the film.
All right. Cheers, Mike. Yeah,
thanks.
No problem.
Thanks so much. Bye.
All right.
Are you an FX Insider? FX Insider is our membership program that gives members access to special, more in-depth, and members-only content. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. In addition, we also do two other regular audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases, as well as covering classic films. The RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. Also, check out our sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.